It's always a good time to talk to Sean McDonough, one of the most versatile broadcasters of his generation and the current voice of Monday Night Football on ESPN. We're especially glad to have him on the show today with the Patriots facing the Dolphins in prime time. I'm Chad Finn, sports media and online columnist at the Boston Globe, filling in for Chris Gasper. It's Monday, December 11th, and this is Season Ticket. Sean, welcome to the podcast.
Nice to be with you, Chad. Big shoes to fill with Chris Gasper, but so far you are off to a flying start. If we can reverse roles, and now I'll be a media critic for a few seconds.
It's tough doing this stuff in front of a broadcaster with your accolades, man.
Well, I think you did an excellent job, and part of me hopes that you don't, so then it'll give everybody out there an appreciation that it isn't as easy as they think. I have buddies of mine all the time who say anybody could do what you do. You just sit up there in a booth and talk about sporting events as they're taking place. So a few times over the years, I have invited some of those people who've said that up to the booth to watch, and I think they get a much different perspective when they see, you know, everything that's going on and everybody gesturing and talking in your ear. There's an awful lot of things that are happening at once that make it not quite as easy as it might appear from the outside.
I don't think they realize somebody's talking in your ear until they see somebody new to broadcasting respond on the air. I think Paul Pierce did this when he first started out and said, okay, nobody knew who he was talking to.
Ex-players or coaches who've auditioned, and I won't mention the one ex-football player who this was about because I wouldn't want to embarrass him, but there was a former NFL wide receiver who was auditioning, and they kept saying in his ear, okay, now don't respond when we talk and you're to us. Just, you know, listen to what we're saying and act upon it. And he kept saying, okay. So they finally said, I don't think this is going to work out with this guy. But, yeah, the good producers and directors, you know, they do a minimal amount of talking, or most of the time when they're talking in your ear, they try to wait until the other guy is talking so it's not jarring to you as you're speaking. But there's a negative in that, too, because a lot of times when they're talking while you're on the air, partner is speaking, you don't really hear clearly what he or she is saying. And then a lot of times they're saying something to you that they're intended to get a response, and you didn't really hear what they said. So that can lead to the occasional awkward moment. But most of the time, the people who have done this a long time kind of understand the mechanics of when's a good time to talk and when isn't.
Plus, you got to deal with all the graphics, what's on the screen in front of you, not to mention the action that's happening on the field, which just gets faster and faster with each passing year. There is so much to it. I don't know how guys like you juggle it like that.
Well, there is a lot to it. You know, there's the old debate in our business about what's harder, radio or TV, and a lot of people would say, oh, it's harder to be the play-by-play person on the radio because you have to paint all of the pictures and describe everything, where on TV, obviously, the people can see the images, so the play-by-play person doesn't have to do as much of that. But, you know, I would argue almost the other side because, you know, on the radio, that's true. You do have to paint all the pictures, but you're also totally in control of the broadcast. I mean, you just talk about whatever you want in whatever order you want, about whatever you want, whereas in TV, you know, sometimes we can control the flow of what we're talking about and the subject matter from one subject to the next. But a lot of times, as you just indicated, you know, we're really reacting to replays and graphics that come up on the screen and flashbacks and that sort of thing. So, you know, there's a lot less control in TV, which I think in some ways actually makes it more difficult.
Yeah, I want to ask you about the upcoming game here with the Patriots and Dolphins, obviously, but you just had one of the more interesting and notable broadcasts on Monday Night Football since you've been doing this job with the vicious Bengals Pittsburgh game last Monday night. You were commended and rightfully for your commentary as some of the dirtier plays occurred in that game. A couple of days after this happens, have your thoughts changed on what you saw?
No, and that's a thoughtful question because, you know, it understands the reality of it, which is, you know, we have to say those things that we're saying on the air in real time. You know, we don't have any time to sit there and think about, okay, what is the appropriate thing to say? What is the thoughtful thing to say? You know, you just have to react instinctively with what your mind and gut tell you and say it. So, you know, that's what I did. That's what John Gruden did. You know, now as the telecast goes along, if you circle back to those things, you had a little more time to think about what you want to say. You know, I appreciate that a lot of people appreciate what I had to say. I also realized, you know, there's a certain population out there says, oh, it's football, it's always been football, and people need to deal with it. So, you know, there was some of that too. But the vast majority of it, I think, I think the vast majority of the people, at least what I've read and heard and people I've talked to, kind of felt the way I did as they watched that, that it kind of had crossed the line from good, hard-hitting, old-fashioned football into a lot of the stuff that has caused concern, you know, whether it's about concussions, player safety, long-term, short-term. And I think, Chad, for me and for Coach Gruden, our response was probably a lot more emotional than it otherwise would have been because of what happened earlier in the game with Ryan Shazier. You know,
right.
They fired him off the field.
Tennessee, and Ryan Shazier, the leader of this Pittsburgh defense, is not getting up.
And that wasn't a dirty play. Unfortunately, it was his own tackling technique, I think, that contributed to it. It's just one of those freak accidents that's really unfortunate. But, you know, it was still the backdrop that this guy had been carted off the field. His legs weren't moving. There was a very real possibility he was seriously injured, maybe even paralyzed. So, you know, to have that as the backdrop and everybody in the stadium watched that, and you could feel the air come out of the entire stadium when that happened, you know, to have it, you know, kind of disintegrate into the kind of game that it became, I think was particularly tough, you know, given what happened with Shazier.
Yeah, the Juju Smith-Schuster play seemed to especially bring some condemnation from people immediately, where he drilled Vontaze Burfict, a guy with a bit of a track record for the Bengals, especially against the Steelers,
right,
in terms of dirty hits. But with the circumstances that you described with Ryan Shazier, I don't know if that was the time for revenge for Pittsburgh.
Two Bell, who got a big block from Smith-Schuster, flattened Burfict, and here come flags from all over the place.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I think that's sort of what prompted my comment about him.
And, John, what I can't believe, on this of all nights, when he and his teammates and everybody else watching this game watched Ryan Shazier get seriously injured, it seemed, that in the front of everybody's mind, to deliver a hit like that that's illegal and then stand over a man who you might have seriously injured, shame on him.
Then I know Antonio Brown said after the game, you know, he took a vicious hit from Burfict in a playoff game 2 years ago that really cost the Bengals a playoff game. You know, he was walking around the locker room as Smith-Schuster was being interviewed saying it was karma. It was karma.
That's not me.
It's called karma.
I apologize for that.
And it's called karma.
Well, okay, maybe it was, but is he going to say the same thing now if in a couple of weeks somebody jacks up Juju Smith-Schuster? You know what I mean? So, you know, I think we need to be careful. Well, all of us need to be careful what we say and realize that it needs to be couched against many backdrops.
It was interesting to me to see Coach Gruden's reaction in real time, where he was clearly put off by this, as you were. And then you go on social media and you see somebody like Troy Aikman, a long accomplished, respected player and broadcaster, saying it was hard to watch for a number of reasons. Is this a almost a tipping point in terms of the perception of football and the violence within it, when you have these respected voices immediately saying, I don't want to see this in the game?
I think so. You know, and obviously there were some people who, as I said earlier, felt the other way. Hey, it's just football. Deal with it. You know, I saw, I think it was Mike Mitchell, the Steelers defensive back, say that. I saw a piece, Dominic Foxworthy on ESPN, one of the online platforms. He wrote an article basically just saying, hey, it's football. Deal with it. You know, there was some of that. But, you know, what bothered me about some of the pushback on John Gruden was, oh, he doesn't like physical football. He doesn't love football. There's nobody who loves any kind of football, physical or otherwise, more than John Gruden. I've never been around anybody maybe who loves anything as much as John Gruden loves football. And he's all for hard-hitting, good, clean physical football. I mean, he's all for hit somebody as hard as you can, you know, as long as it's in the way that it should be. So, you know, that some of the pushback on him bothered me. But, yeah, I do think it's a tipping point. I think we saw that, Chad, in the reaction of the league. You know, they issued suspensions to Iloka for his hit. Now, that got overturned, and Smith-Schuster got suspended as well, where I think up until now, you know, those kinds of hits have basically been disciplined with fines. Now they're going to suspensions, and they're talking apparently about perhaps in the competition committee discussing something like the college rule, where if you get a targeting penalty, you're ejected immediately. So, I think it might have served as a bit of a tipping point.
We talk about these guys like Coach Gruden, who have been around the game forever and have a idea of how the game should be played in their mind. You're from a football family as well. Your father, Will, of course, was the longtime and respected Globe football writer for years and years. I'm curious what you think, how you think he would view the modern NFL game. Would he be okay with what we saw the other night, or would he be outraged?
Yeah, I don't think he'd be okay.
Yeah.
You know, I think most people who have, I don't want to say a brain in their head because that's a really bad choice of words considering what we're talking about. But, you know, I don't think, you know, George Iloka could say, and his agent said, you know, well, it was a moving target. You know, you can't, it's hard to hit the receiver right where you want to because, you know, the receiver's moving. You know, George Iloka launched himself headfirst into the upper body of Antonio Brown. And anybody who watched that saw that. You know, I don't know anybody, you know, who, well, I shouldn't say that because I've read commentary the last couple of days from a few people who seem to think that's what football should be. I really don't think that's what my dad would think it should be. Or most people, you know, I think the vast majority of the response has been along the lines of what I said, what John Gruden said, what Troy Aikman said, and what many people have written around the country.
Yeah, it seems like common sense, doesn't it, that at some point you're going to be outraged by what you see if it goes too far, and last Monday went too far. We had a little example of that,
too.
Yeah,
I mean, I have a lot of friends of mine, love football, love hard-hitting physical football, as I do. As you said, I've been around it my whole life. You know, that crossed the line, I think, and I think most people who look at it from a reasonable point of view would feel the same way.
We'll have more with Sean McDonough here at Monday Night Football play-by-play voice and former voice of the Boston Red Sox for a long time as well. Well-known here in New England right after the break. We'll talk about some controversy going on here with the Patriots with Rob Gronkowski and the Monday night game between the Patriots and Dolphins. Stick around. Welcome back. If you like Season Ticket, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribing is the best way to make sure you get the latest episode as soon as it's available. Back now with Sean McDonough. Well, Sean, we had a little controversy here last week in New England that was similar to what happened in the Monday night game. Rob Gronkowski suspended for a cheap shot on a Bills defensive back late in the Patriots' victory. He's going to miss a game as well. Is this going to affect the Patriots, in your mind, going into this game Monday, losing one of the most dynamic offensive players in the league?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it certainly can't help. And obviously, they've done a great job without him over the years. I think since his rookie year of 2010, they're 20-5 without him. I believe they were 9-0 without him last year. You know, they won the Thursday night game in Tampa this year without him. But you know, they struggled in the red zone in that game. They won 19-14. Brady threw for 303 yards, but they kicked four field goals. And obviously, Rob Gronkowski is a great red zone target in addition to his many other skills. But the Patriots coaching staff, you know, they just do such a great job of reinventing themselves when situations like this come up. You know, they've done a great job all year this year dealing with the lack of Julian Edelman. And, you know, they've gone to a kind of a running back-centric, you know, run game and pass game with some creative use of James White and Deion Lewis and Rex Burkhead. So, yeah, I think they'll find a way. I think they're sufficiently better than the Dolphins that they'll still likely win the game. But, you know, it can only hurt when you don't have him.
This is the Patriots' second meeting with the Dolphins in 3 weeks. The cliche is familiarity breeds contempt. They got a lot of shots in on Brady in that game, and he did have Gronkowski in that game. He had two touchdowns, one of his better games of the season. When teams play so close to each other like this, does that add to the, I guess, the rivalry and the feud of the battle on the field that they're so familiar?
Yeah, I think it adds to the chippiness, and it'll be interesting to see. You know, we spent a lot of time on this podcast talking about chippiness and you know, reading up for this game, watching the tape of that game on November 26th between the Dolphins and Patriots in Foxborough. You know, there was kind of a chippy on the edge game, and you're right. I mean, they hit Brady, I believe it was 7 times. You know, the Patriots pulled away late. The Dolphins made a couple of key mistakes, including an interception in the end zone that obviously really hurt them. So, yeah, it's the old cliche. I think the game was a little bit closer than the score would indicate. The Patriots have had a lot of problems in Miami over the years, as every Patriot fan knows. Brady is 7-8 in Miami in his career. But, I think I read in one of the articles today that the Patriots are still 11-point favorites. So
that's crazy.
Yeah, those people. It seemed a little odd to me, but I think it's great respect for, what the Patriots have accomplished. And to me, the most amazing thing that's happened with almost any team in the league this year is the dramatic change of the Patriot defense. At the beginning of the year, everybody's saying, what is going on? You know, those first four games, in three out of the four, they gave up 33 points or more. They gave up 32 points per game in those four, and they went 2-2. Now they've won 8 in a row, and nobody scored more than 17 points against them since. So it's a dramatic turnaround on the defensive side, really with a bunch of guys. You know, John Gruden was talking about this when we chatted the other day. You know, to a lot of the nation, outside of Patriot Nation, there's a lot of no-names on this Patriot defense. And, again, I think it goes back to the coaching of Belichick and Matt Patricia to solve the problems and get it corrected. And, they're playing outstanding defense.
In your preparation for this game, have you talked to anybody, or have you thought yourself that there's reasons for skepticism about this defense? They've been on a great roll, but not a lot of depth in the front seven. The defensive backfield seems to be carrying the brunt of the load there. Are people believing that this is legitimate with their D?
Well, John Gruden's believing, and he does more film study. I mean, he's probably watched every snap that they've played this year, including the preseason, and I'm not exaggerating. I mean, that's how deep he gets into the preparation. And we get the benefit of his film study and wisdom all week long. And, he's a believer. It's a lot of guys, as I said, who aren't household names to fans around the country, but they're playing really well, individually and collectively, and it seems like different guys step up. I watched the tape of the game in Buffalo last week. The first series, Buffalo marches right down the field, and then Eric Lee gets an interception. I'm thinking, who is Eric Lee? So, there are some unfamiliar names, but I think it's legitimate what they're doing. And when you do it for 8 weeks in a row, if you could throw in a couple good weeks and maybe there's a week or two, you can say, well, the competition isn't very good. But I think when it's gone on this long, it's not a fluke.
Yeah, maybe that is the case. It's been sustained for longer than anybody would think. I got to ask you the obligatory question that's going to be asked until this guy retires, whenever that happens. How is Tom Brady?
John Gruden will be on Monday Night Football next year.
That's 1A. The actual.
Is that going to be the question?
That's next. The actual.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
The actual football question is how long is Tom Brady going to be the quarterback of the Patriots? How the heck is he doing this?
Well, I do think it is remarkable, and I do think it's testimony to what he's doing with TB12 and, his diet and workout regimen and everything that he does in terms of the stretching and flexibility and pliability, and he's in phenomenal shape. And, I just think some of the things that he's always had help his longevity, too. To me, he's been the best I've ever seen at that one little step or two in the pocket, feeling the rush, sensing where it's coming from, feeling where there's a little room for him to move in one direction or another to just get that split second extra that he needs to get a throw off. I mean, Patriot fans have been watching him do that since 2001. I think he's the best ever at that. And he's not only been productive in completing a lot of passes that way, but he saved himself a lot of hits too. So he's remarkable. He says he wants to play another 4 or 5 years, and I don't know. I think you'd have to be insane to bet against him. So good luck to him. To me, he's the greatest quarterback of all time. You have all the factors that have gone into changing this franchise around, and, the Krafts and Bill Belichick and Brady all deserve credit. I think, Brady's the most important thing because you don't dominate like they have. You don't become a dynasty like they have without that kind of a quarterback.
This isn't supposed to happen for anything close to the length they've done it at. I'm curious, when did you realize he was the greatest quarterback who ever played?
Well, it was a while ago because, he's been doing it for a very long time now. I'm not exactly sure when, but I've been saying it for several years, so it would be at least several years. And I'm biased. I've gotten to know him personally a little bit, and I just think the world of him as a person as well as what he does professionally.
All right, now it's question 1A or whatever that was supposed to be. Not whether John Gruden's going to be back, but what's it like to work with him? This is year two for you guys. You seem to really...
Oh, it's a lot of fun. Yeah. You know, it took a little getting used to. You know, he's extremely intense, as I think anybody who watches Monday Night Football knows, and I knew that from watching it many times, you know, over the years, and also from talking to Mike Tirico, who was my predecessor and worked with John for, I guess it was 7 years. It's fun. You know, as I said, he loves football. He's a very interesting guy, you know, and not just about football. When you hang around him, they get his worldview on a wide variety of subjects. It's always interesting and delivered with a similar passion that he passes along his football analysis on Monday Night Football. So I think it's made me a better prepared broadcaster, certainly, by working with him.
I know you recognize the appeal and magnitude of getting the Monday Night Football gig. Is it everything you expected it to be? Is anything different or surprising about it?
No, it's pretty much everything that I thought it would be. You know, I guess I've been around this business so long that, you know, I kind of had a little understanding about the size of the show and the reach of the audience. You know, the one thing that's really changed for me, I'm 55. I've been doing this a long time, as you said. You know, get recognized fairly frequently here around Boston. But even though I've done a lot of national events over the years, I could fairly comfortably travel around the country and not get recognized very often. And, you know, that has completely changed. And I knew it was going to because, as I said, Mike Tirico is a really good friend of mine. And I've spent a lot of time with him over the years in various places, restaurants, golf courses, you know, traveling to games that we were events we did together, like the U.S. Open Golf or the British Open Golf. And he was constantly recognized everywhere we went. So, you know, I knew that was going to happen, and it has happened. And, you know, I'm fine with it. I didn't get into this to be a TV person. I really got into it because I love sports and came to love as a very young kid sports broadcasting. But, you know, the vast majority of the people, everybody really has been so nice that, you know, I don't, rather than view it as any kind of negative or an inconvenience, I have enjoyed it. I've met a lot of nice people as a result of that.
Have you had to put together your own entourage and a team of toadies and lackeys and that sort of thing?
No, I like to be about as low maintenance as I possibly can. And I think I have enough friends of mine that if I ever tried to do that, they would tell me I was a jerk and to knock it off, and that wouldn't last very long. So, yeah, I'm enjoying the heck out of it. You know, as I said to you and to a lot of other people a year and a half ago when I got the job, you know, it was an emotional experience for me, thinking a lot about my dad and watching Monday Night Football with my dad when I was a kid and how cool he would think this is. And it's hard to believe it's been almost 15 years now that he's been gone. But it still holds that appeal for, I think, the vast majority of the people who make their living in the league and a lot of the people who watch it.
Hey, you even hear that from the Patriots guys who never say anything. They volunteer how excited they are to be playing on Monday night, which is...
Yeah, that's still the way they feel. And I get it because, you know, I grew up feeling like Monday Night Football special, and I still do. Yeah, I've said it a number of times last year and a half. I stand in that booth every Monday night, and they're counting down, that red carpet open is airing, and that unbelievable iconic theme music's playing, and I still get chills going through my body. And it's pretty awesome. And I think if you start to take that for granted, that's when you need to get out and go do something else.
Well, one more quick one for you, Sean. I know you're around here all the time, and I'm curious, people must constantly still ask you about the Red Sox and recognize you around here as with your role with that for, was it 16, 17 years?
Yes, 17 seasons.
Yeah, isn't that, that's never going to go away for you, is it?
No, and I think of all the things that I've done, you know, Monday Night Football is awesome, and having the chance to do the World Series when I was at CBS was awesome, but, you know, when I was a little kid, knowing at a very young age that I wanted to do this, probably 5 or 6 years old, I wanted to be Ned Martin or Ken Coleman. And, you know, when I got the chance to do that when I was 25 years old, you know, I'll never forget sitting at Fenway Park on opening day in 1988 thinking, oh, my goodness, you know, I am about to live the thing that I've been dreaming of since I was 5 or 6 years old. And, you know, to have a chance to do it when Ned and Ken were still there as Red Sox broadcasters, you know, I was doing the over-the-air TV, Ned was doing the Nesson TV, and Ken Coleman was a part of the radio broadcast. You know, that was such a thrill for me. So I think of all the things that have happened and will happen in my professional life, the chance to do the Red Sox games will always be the thing that meant the most to me.
I'm just going to assume your dad told you there's more money in TV than sports
he
writing,
did.
By the way.
That's why, people always say, why'd you pick TV instead of newspapers or whatever? And, I was coming out of high school in the late 70s, early 80s. Cable TV was really just coming into being. ESPN was barely on the air. I think Nesson was kind of on the drawing board. But he saw that coming, and he also saw that even then, newspapers were starting to struggle a little bit, and there were already cities that had more than one newspaper that all of a sudden had one.
Yeah.
And, there was talk for a long time in Boston that maybe the Herald might go away. In recent years, maybe the Globe might go away. So, I don't know that he saw all that coming to that extent, but he certainly said to me more than once, there's going to be a lot more opportunity in broadcasting, and those people make more money, which I think he said with some bitterness at the time. But then he got onto the TV part of it himself, and it came at a really great time in his life and in the life of our family.
Well, no surprise that he saw the future. He had a pretty good knack for that. Hey, Sean, thanks for coming on today. This is a great conversation. Look forward to hearing you Monday night.
My pleasure, Chad. Nice job. I'm going to write a full critique. I don't know where it'll be able to be read, but I'm going to evaluate your performance.
I look forward to your new blog, Sean. Thank you.
Well, happy holidays to you, my friend. Thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
And that's it for this edition of Season Ticket, a production of the Boston Globe and WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. If you've enjoyed the show, please tell a friend and leave us a review. I'm Chad Finn, in for Chris Gasper. We'll see you Tuesday.